Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Welcome back to this episode of Her Leading Story. I am so excited for this episode. I will be interviewing my good friend, Amanda Mayu, and I'll read a little bit of her bio and then let her introduce herself. Amanda is an executive career coach supporting corporate working professionals. She has had 13 years of experience working alongside business leaders and growing companies of all sizes, but focusing in the technology, advertising, marketing, and fashion industries. She's currently an executive recruiter for Meta/Facebook. For their global business leadership team. And she's been at Meta for the last 5 or more years. She has a bias for taking aligned action and a passion for optimizing life. I'm so excited to talk to Amanda because in my role, I often hear from my clients or other people looking for jobs about what the role of the recruiter is. And I wanted to not only hear about how Amanda ended up as a recruiter, but what kind of wisdom she might have to share about hunting for a job. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. Welcome to Amanda. I am so happy to be here for this episode interviewing my dear friend Amanda on Her Leading Story. And I think I'll first let Amanda introduce herself to you and talk a little bit about what she does right now for her career.
Thanks, Julie. I'm Amanda Mayu. I currently am an executive recruiter at Meta. I've been recruiting for about 13 years now in a variety of different industries and levels and various experiences, but my last several years within big tech and at the leadership and executive level. So yeah, thrilled to be here. Excited to be invited on.
I'm so excited to talk to you because I know I get asked all the time about, like, should I talk to a recruiter? What kind of recruiter should I be talking to? And we will get to that. But I wanted to talk first because this podcast is all about like career paths and how women decide what they're going to do and decide they're going to pivot and, you know, the various ways that sort of like work and life and all of those things end up sort of melding together. And, you know, I don't even think I know what you majored in college. You know what I mean? Like, I know you pretty well, but I don't think I know.
Yeah.
Because you can't major in recruiting.
No, yeah, I mean, there's angles, but yeah, it's a funny story. And I certainly do not use my bachelor's degree nor my minor really in my function. But yeah, I studied textiles, apparel, and merchandising at Louisiana State University. I thought you knew that, but it's just, yeah. You know, it's not super adjacent to what I do now. But my, you know, path into recruiting is very much on the heels of my degree. So happy to kind of give that overview now. Would be helpful. So yeah, I mean, I'm fourth generation LSU Tiger. My grandparents went there, great grandparents, actually, grandfather's grandparents, my parents, and then me. Two older sisters who neither of which went there. So I was also the first grandchild to go to LSU. And I didn't really have anywhere else that felt organic for me to go. And like the programs I was really interested in were either interior design or a textiles and merchandising. I was very into home decor and interior design as a kid. And the program that just felt right for me was this textiles program. I did minor in business, which was an easy add-on with a merchandising angle, which is what my specialty is in. But I did have a little bit of a minor emphasis in textiles as well. And then my, let's see, summer between junior and senior year, I did have an internship at Ralph Lauren in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in product development, which is that middle part between the design and the actual merchandising. there's not really a ton of people that kind of know that space. And I was within the Lauren division, which is one of the largest divisions of Ralph Lauren at the time. And it actually encompasses about 6 or 7 different brands, or at least that was true at the time. But, you know, very mainstream merchandising or mainstream apparel, rather, of their offering. And I was in the denim division in particular, denim and wovens. And I spent a lot of my summer running around the garment district in New York City, getting bottoms of legs washed to show what a full denim piece of like the whiskering and the various fading and the color and the wash, because denim comes really raw. Then you have to stylize it. And there's various different things that happen to break down the cotton and you know, your cotton, if it stretches, all those different things. I spent a lot of time cutting up fabric that we shipped overseas to our various vendors and then receiving samples back to try to find, you know, really high quality either linen aesthetic or silk aesthetic, or even, you know, various denim and chambrays at, you know, a really affordable price point. These were, you know, parts of their category that was just so mainstream in the US. Like my mom was the main shopper of their product. So after that summer, I mean, I had a blast. I learned a lot. It really opened my eyes to sitting in the seat of what I was studying to be. And I was kind of like, I actually don't think I want to be in this angle. I could do it. I definitely will come back to New York. That was a clear yes for me, was spending, you know, time in New York. And that was a vision of mine since I was a kid. But I remember joking with a friend of mine, fall maybe of senior year, we were in an HR class as part of our program. I think it was called like organizational development or something as part of our program. And maybe it was part of my business minor as well. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just do like HR for a fashion company, you know, and it was sort of a joke. And then we like moved on. So then I graduate, I moved to New York City, brought 3 suitcases with me, had a place to sleep for 10 days. I was subletting from someone who was subletting. I'm packed with an air mattress to New York. I had nothing to lose, which was kind of crazy at the time of how just like fearless and brave I was and moving. But I had, I think, 7 or 8 interviews lined up for various jobs.
Oh, wow.
A lot of them in product development, some of them in retail adjacent, which is what I did a lot growing up as well. And I had 2 job offers in hand. And I tell you this long-winded story of just like, it'll get to where we're going. One was with American Eagle in denim development, higher pay than the job I ended up taking. And I was just kind of like that. It was a clear no for me. And the job I ended up taking, which took multiple rounds of interviews, but it did come together pretty quickly, was a retail management job at Bloomingdale's flagship store on 59th Street. Iconic Bloomingdale's. So here I am, 22. I turned 23 September. This is all summer of 2011, by the way. Yeah. And I step into this role of, I was in the home store, which is the category. I mean, you see my background. Mm-hmm. Like I love still home design and home textiles. Yeah. It was bedding and towels and all of that home stuff, not necessarily furniture, but all of the other soft goods of home.
Yeah.
Ralph Lauren was a huge vendor as well. And I stepped into this role and was talking to people and managing a tenured staff and unioned staff for the first time. I had a manager that I reported into. We were both responsible for the business side and the people side. So a big portion of my role was people development. It was making sure that sales goals were met by the people on the floor in the retail store selling. Mm-hmm. I managed up to executives. Literally, the CEO of Bloomingdale's had his office on my floor of the flagship store.
Yeah.
CEO of the company walked on my sales floor every single day, as well as the president of Bloomingdale's and a bunch of other key executives. They came in and out of my container of my store every day. So that really kind of, I think, up-leveled my experience. The second floor ready to wear, or, you know, the second floor shoes, or, you know, fourth floor high fashion. I was kind of right in it. And I loved the variety of people I spoke to. I loved the diversity of people I spoke to. Like, I knew that I was going to talk to people for a living. I just had no clue at the time, like what it really was.
Yeah. Right.
So I stuck through that role. It was hard because it was still retail hours. I was in a, you know, management position, but we worked like holiday hours. So it's, you know, December, and our store would be open 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And like a week or two maybe before Christmas was 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. And we worked these like crazy hours. And I was managing a sales floor and managing up to executives, our business reports and everything, I was asked to lead the holiday shop, which included hiring seasonal development and merchandising the entire store. So I sort of ran my own store within Bloomingdale's a year into being on the job. So all of a sudden I was sitting in HR, and hiring was part of my process, but I was sitting in HR hiring 45 people that I was going to manage for the next 12 weeks from front of house, people at the register, customer service roles, and back of house, all of our support staff too. So that was kind of my first taste of like what recruiting was. Although I didn't go find the talent, I was just the final sign off. Like I was the person who stamped like, yes, I want to hire this person.
Yeah.
Then my manager left and I got promoted after the holiday shop into the manager of the team that I had just been the assistant of. And I stuck with that for a while. Again, a ton of executive interaction, really being responsible for all of the business outcome, which at the time, like, blows my mind because I was maybe 25. It was the largest division. The largest division. It's wild.
So you were young and hungry.
Young and hungry and wildly naive. I learned a lot. I managed someone who had started at the company before my parents even graduated high school. Like these were, again, union staff. I was there for a lot of union negotiations, which was also interesting. One of the interesting parts about that job too was I negotiated a lot of salary. It was an interesting model. So brands will create specialty roles so that a seller on the floor manages their business exclusively and is sort of like the person who knows what merchandise is coming. The price points of this product was anywhere from super accessible, like store level, all the way to like Pratese, Frate, like super high end. So we had these specialty roles that were paid a salary on top of what their Bloomingdale salary was. That bringing in business and helping people find careers within Bloomingdale's. Also, let's go back for a moment to my holiday staff, finding them positions within the store full time because a lot of them were seasonal. And so it was a lot of like managing your best people and incentivizing them to continue to deliver. I had a woman on my floor who sold over $1 million every year. And you're like, what? So they, like, buying that commission, you're like, that's a pretty interesting career path to take, you know?
Yeah.
Made some retirees who did this to still, like, it was a passion and a hobby of theirs. You know, they were Upper East Side ladies who wanted to do this. I had folks who were mid-career, like had no clue what they were going to do. And they were like, I need to make money. The fastest way to do it is work this commission job, you know, minus a restaurant, which is the big, you know, industry in New York as well. So just a ton of variety and like, what was I doing? So I think at the most I had about 65 people that I was responsible for and a sales plan of like many millions. I think 25 or six was the highest. $26 million I'm responsible for delivering to the flagship Bloomingdale's home store. So yeah, interesting start to a career. And then I knew that I wanted to do something different. The holiday hours and the fact that I grew up in the South, I was living in New York City. When I wanted to see family and when everyone was off, I was stuck in the-
You couldn't go.
Now I work every Black Friday, every day after Christmas. So I knew I was ready for a change. And I was looking to use my production and or my production experience as well as my, you know, merchandising background and started to apply for a few roles. And one of the roles that I applied to was at a staffing agency. And the person interviewed me. It was sort of a ghost posting for a role that they were filling. And I was already, you know, making more than the position was filled for. But the girl was like, you should be a recruiter. What are you doing working this job? You'd be a great recruiter. And I was like, huh? So I went in and interviewed and I joined their fashion specialty division. So I was filling merchant assistants and I was filling design assistants and then I was filling, you know, production people. So my degree was all of a sudden being left.
Oh, I see.
I knew the roles and I knew how it fit. And I was able to educate my peers on the team who maybe didn't study fashion, how this role fit and what was the nuance of this role. And we had a lot of people on our team who had converted from working in the industry and got flipped also like me to a recruiter. And then people who just kind of fell into it because that's recruiting. So I did that job for a few years, worked in a more specialty vertical within that, to where I was filling permanent roles at senior executive levels. So staffing agencies have temporary positions and direct hire positions. So the direct hire is where you work on a commission to fill a position, and then you take a cut of the salary, and that's the money that you make. The temporary positions, there's always a markup. So if anyone ever has questions about contract roles, always happy to chat about that as well. Bill rate versus hourly rate. But I was filling some senior level direct hire placement roles there, which is definitely now translates to my executive recruiting. I got recruited out of that into a client that I had, which was a startup. I quickly got laid off 5 months in. So that was a career journey as well. And then I took a different job in a tech consulting role, which someone from the startup had referred me for. They had actually taken the job kind of in a similar stopgap and then found something else that they were doing and made my name as a recommendation. And then I was in a position, and you and I can talk about this a little bit, you know, down the road as just kind of careers and life happens. But I knew I was ready to leave New York, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do and what that looked like.
Yeah.
So I was starting to take a gamble on like, how should I position my career so that I can be in something that's not New York dependent. So
fashion is so New York dependent.
Fashion is so New York dependent. Yeah. Recruiting not, but I was recruiting mostly for fashion or marketing and creative roles. And so then I actually took a risk and did a few years of contract work where I wasn't, one time I was working under an agency, but one time I was working direct through the company. So I worked at a advertising agency, essentially knowing that I was, you know, on an hourly rate with a higher markup. And that was an interesting position, filling, you know, all sorts of different roles within an ad agency.
Yeah.
So learning that business model was also different. And then I worked for a few months for Major League Soccer. So for sports, but the corporate office. So I worked on anything that would be, you know, the business side of house.
Like accountants and...
Accountants, event teams and finance positions and HR and sales and, you know, all the stuff that happens at the league level. So when people don't understand that, I'm like, but the NFL is not every single team. It's the NFL and then there's every single team.
Yeah, right.
And Major League Soccer was rapidly growing. They were in a major expansion phase, as they still are. And so that was a real fun kind of whirlwind. And then a friend of mine referred me into Facebook at the time, is what we were called. And I joined the team there originally that recruited for recruiters. So it was a little meta at the time, but it was crazy fast. It was a little different than the style of recruiting I had done in-house. In that it wasn't as consultative. It was a lot more agency staffing style. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I kind of moved away from this. It's not what I wanted. I had some career shuffles, joined a few different teams, and I'm now on our executive recruiting team. So that was maybe a little long-winded, but maybe
no, that's super helpful.
Added some color and flavor to return.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's, I think when we met, was that when you, how long, you just been there a year maybe?
Maybe not quite a year, actually, because you and I met early 2019. Yeah. So I had been there coming up on a year.
Yeah. I kind of remember that. And so was that, so in between, you were working contract jobs until you got that full time. Oh, okay. What did you do for health insurance? I'm just curious.
Yeah. Oh, totally. So I was a healthy, fit individual who was just, you know, taking our gamble. I went uninsured for most of one of the contracts and then joined through how I was employed by Major League Soccer. I was able to join theirs temporarily, but
But I mean, you're in your late 20s. I mean, it's not like...
Yeah, I was in my late 20s at the time.
Probably
27 to 30 is when I had those roles.
And then was that a big transition in terms of... I mean, you're recruiting recruiters first. And then I think when we met, you were also like recruiting engineers and software design people.
I have not been on the eng side, actually.
You've not been on that.
Finance and accounting when you...
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And still sort of figuring out like, what the hell am I doing here? Because it's not... I had been shifted quite a bit and had had some different, you know, we want you to do this now. And I was like, wait, what? Like, this is not what I... thought I was signing up for. So yeah, but the transition from having been a contractor without say, career development activity because, you know, the company didn't have to invest in me in that same way without the same goals. Or, I mean, obviously, I knew what my metrics and goaling were to show up as a performer, but they weren't, say, like looming over me, and they weren't kind of hanging over as like, you know, this will impact my bonus or this will impact my performance rating or anything of that nature. And so I also was able at any point that I just stopped liking a company to like fully walk away. You know, like I could have given short notice and had said to a company or said to the, you know, one of the agencies that placed me in the role, who actually that company wanted to hire me full time. And I was like, I've got a great gig going right now being a consultant, because I was trying to leave New York, and I ultimately did around the time that you and I met as well. But it gave me the flexibility to shift my life and my interest without being, you know, fully in something. But that transition from having been a contractor for, gosh, 2 years to being a full-time employee at a major tech organization, like I never played at that level before, you know, just based on the companies I had been at and kind of the smaller shops where I was a much bigger fish in a small pond, you know, it was a real transition. And that's a lot of when you and I met and what I was working through at the time.
I know. Cause it took you a few months to be able to like realize the, cause at that point, I think you knew that you wanted to be, to move to DC to be closer to one of your siblings and some friends that you have there. And it was just time. And so, but you had gotten hired out of the New York office. And I remember there was a lot of navigating both like, what is my role here? And like, why is it operating this way? And like your desire to move. And remember, this is before the pandemic and like remote work. And so there was like, you were reminding me the other day that it was like you were waiting for a desk to become open or something like that.
I had 9 months of purgatory from when I asked to move. So you were right. I started in our New York office. There was a DC location. I have family here, wanted to move close by, ready for something different, asked to move. It was approved. But the reason I couldn't move anytime soon was because they were out of space. They no longer had desks available in the office that I was moving into. And it was around the time that we had some legal stuff going on, our FTC consent order, things of that nature. And I was deemed non-essential. I was recruiting for finance and accounting at the time, which was mostly based in Menlo Park, some in Austin, but majority in Menlo Park. So I was also not adjacent to, I was the only person on my team based in New York. It was bizarre that I was even there. But that was the shuffle of, after recruiting for recruiters was done, we all kind of got flung into different pockets. And where I originally was landed was not initially a match for me. Worked through that as well. So then I waited for 9 months for a desk to become available. I started on the DC office at the start of 2020, and about 6.5-7 weeks later, what is a desk? And what is a location? And there were so many tax implications and reasons why I couldn't move. I wasn't allowed to move to the DC office yet because I had to be deemed a New York employee until the day that I could, you know, plug in my monitor and laptop at my DC desk. And then obviously the world totally changed and it's a whole different game now. But that was an interesting, I could definitely advise someone to do this, but it was a big gamble again that I took of realizing that what I wanted was to not be in New York anymore, and I wanted to move. And so I technically moved my possessions, left my Brooklyn apartment, got my stuff in my basement of my sister's house, actually, and then lived with friends and Airbnb'd and kind of had a very different, I was a nomad in my city and I was a nomad at work. Like, it was pretty bizarre. My best friend had a second bedroom. One of my good coworkers had a dog, and I dog sat for her all through summer while she was traveling and gallivanting. And, you know, I kind of made it work and, you know, rented Airbnbs whenever I needed to kind of fill the gaps, and spent some time in DC. And, you know, my address, my employer understood my address to actually be my desk location in the New York office. So our physical office building is where all my mail came to and where my tax records and stuff showed that I lived. And a good friend had moved into my Brooklyn apartment as well. So I always kind of had that as a backup to crash into. But a little bit of kind of how I started in New York is definitely how I left, because it took me many months of like, sofa surfing and subletting. And, you know, like, it takes a lot to sign a New York lease and to kind of, you know, commit. It's a first month, last month security deposit. You know, there's, you need 40 times the rent, 80 times the rent, depending on, you know, different things. So it took a while to really kind of land in an apartment, and then funny to reflect on how I exited as well, being how I came in is how I left. So
there have been a couple of times, like, in your, like, career path to where you are now, where you said, like, earlier you were talking about how you had those two job offers and you just knew, like, one was a yes. And then, like, later with this situation with moving, you just knew, right, that it was time for you to move to DC, and you just, like, gave up your lease and started making it happen. So, like, I think my question for you is, like, how do you know when you know?
Yeah. Well, the older I get, the more I realize that that women's intuition is definitely a thing. That's a signal. When I was younger, gosh, how did I know? It just was so true. And I think it was before fear and worry and narrative kind of took over. A lot of us are informed on others' opinions, societal opinions, what we think we should be doing. You know, I had already taken the bold move from the South to, like, move to New York and kind of do something different and, you know, not get married right after LSU and, you know, settle down. And
we're just going to let Amanda do what Amanda does.
We're just like, no one got it. Yeah. Well, so what's so funny, I had a few other job offers too. In fact, someone I worked with at a startup I went to, I knew I was on the market for something different. Came to me with a job offer. I mean, I met all the way through with the CEO and everything, had the offer in hand. And I mean, my body just shut down. This was probably maybe a year and a half or two before I met you.
Yeah.
And I had the offer in hand and just knew what my life would look like working for this person and how this person made me feel. And I called them and said, like, I am so sorry, but I have to decline. You know, and then that opened the doors for me to work under a wonderful person who has definitely been a career mentor and someone very similar to how, like, your and our relationship has, you know, evolved and been such an influence. And then obviously opened the door also to join Meta and Facebook at the time, but definitely would have taken me down a different path. Definitely came with more title and more clout, but was not how I wanted. I knew how my body felt as I got the news that I had the offer. And that was a clear sign right there. And So, I mean, I'm still working on, like, developing my intuition and keeping that signal open. And
yeah,
a lot of that comes with spending, you know, more quiet time with yourself and, you know, really kind of feeling into those pieces and journaling and finding that stillness. I don't think I was so practiced every time, but I think that signal and that body sensation, I definitely knew to not go against and to make it a real signal and a sign for me.
Why do you think you took so many risks, even at a young age? Like, I mean, I know you went to LSU and that made everybody in your family happy, but then it's like New York, like this. I mean, were you, like, a risk taker as a child, or?
Oh, Julie. Well, I mean, maybe if my parents were on this interview, they would have different opinion. I think there's some boldness to me that I don't live in. I don't every day. I mean, even thinking about getting ready for this recording right now, like, I don't walk around being like, I'm so bold and brave, but, like, I think I'm able to bet on myself and feel confident in my capabilities. I think about even the transition leaving New York, knowing it was time, knowing that that was another big risk, but having a lot more to lose than joining, you know, or going to New York. And some of those early career days, you know, people take career risks all the time. That might put a lot on the line. And that's, you know, a lot. And I've been able to do that with just me under kind of my responsibility and not a family of other people. So that's helped some too. But I do think that there's some level of just trust in myself and how I'll figure it out and get through it. And, you know, it was naive when I was young, and now it's a little bit more
part of your personality.
Maybe. I'm just a little bit practiced, but I definitely was, you know, confident in myself.
Yeah.
So
Well, and what's interesting too is that despite the sort of delay for you to move to DC and this like sort of like when you and I met, it was like a lot. You were like really wrestling with like your role and the way the team that you were on was working and structured, and you didn't know if staying at Facebook/Meta was really going to be in your future. And what I think is so interesting, and I wonder if you could speak to it, is how, like, when we think about like making a change or doing a pivot, a lot of times we think about like, okay, I just need to leave this place and find another. And I think that's definitely something you were considering. But I also know, since, you know, over the last few years, that thing you have, maybe it's through like your sort of personality plus like the opportunities at Meta, that you've really been able to like come to peace and really enjoy being doing what you're doing right now, right? So can you talk a little bit about that? Like what had to happen for that shift for you to sort of feel like, was it you doing things? Was it, I mean, like what happened?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my short answer is like a lot of personal growth happened at that time. So we in recruiting often have like different roles as different parts of the process. So there's top of the funnel, there's bottom of the funnel. That means like candidates coming in versus like job offers coming out. And a lot of what my fighting was like where I fit in the total process. So this total, I mean, sales funnels are very well known. So think of it that way. So like, you know, getting all the way down through the process to an offer in hand for whatever you're filling. Engineering hiring has their own funnel, but the business side, which is what I've been doing since I joined, I've always been on the business side of things. Mm-hmm. I really struggled when I was lifted and shifted, is sometimes what I like to say, out of my initial role that I joined the company for into a different part of the process, and really was like, well, this isn't my skill. This isn't my specialty. This isn't like my finesse and my like, you know, actual craft is not on that part of the process, which was moving from the bottom of the funnel to the top of the funnel. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was moved onto a team that was entirely based on the West Coast. Everyone was in the Menlo Park office or San Francisco. They kind of split their time. I was, you know, head on a screen in New York City, like literally 3,000 miles away, and or whatever the distance is. Yeah. And, you know, was not building relationship, was not at the lunch table with my team, which, you know, is something that's different about our company because we have those amenities and on-site services for us. So everyone does eat together. There's a lot of kind of community built in. And I was the only person who, you know, couldn't reach over and touch my manager's desk. And, you know, a lot of that kind of that felt off and different. And there was some part of my like, oh, we're putting you here. This is temporary. And then it became apparent that like, actually, this is your new team now. And so joining something would be like, oh, I'm just gonna stick this out and see how it feels versus like, shit, this is actually my team. Like, this is the dynamic I'm in. Like, and that's kind of when you and I met. I was, version was happening from you are now here. This is your job. And so I really had to go within myself and say, do I want to leave on my terms or do I want to leave by being told it's time? And that was a big, like, I had that conversation with myself. This might be a total side note, but I played violin as a kid for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Forgotten all of it. The muscle memory is gone.
Yeah.
I wanted to play violin because I had a friend, one of my mom's best friend's daughters also played violin. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. So my mom buys a violin, signs me up. I do it for a while and decide I don't want to do it anymore. And I'm like, hey mom, I want to quit violin. And she's like, nope. I'm like, what? I told you I wanted to do it. Now I'm telling you I want to quit. And she knew I was no longer happy playing violin. She was like, you're not going to quit when you're not happy. You're going to quit when you're back in love with it again. And I hated that philosophy at the time. I hated it. And like, man, it has proved so valuable to have had that experience with the low, low cost of violin lessons. So, you know, that was a character builder for sure. Uh-huh. And obviously when I was experiencing it. So, you know, I kind of had a wake up call by a good friend of mine. One of the times I visited you in Chicago, one of my coworkers and good friends there, we were on different teams. We started in the same function and he kind of was watching from afar my transition. And I think I was probably complaining. And he just said like, have you actually given this like a shot. Have you actually tried yet? And I was like, you know, so pissed off. And then realized like, no, I'm really kind of one foot out on this job. So once I decided like, I am going to make this job my mission, and I am not like change my personality, but I'm going to, when I'm on the clock doing this job, I'm going to give it my all. That really shifted how I related to the work and the people around me. Mm. I showed up choosing to do the work versus fighting to do the work. And I gamified it. Like, there are places in my life that if I decide to like play this little, like make it fun for me, then I turn on and I buy in. And so I had to figure out how to gamify my job. And once I did, I was like crushing my metrics, you know, had like reviews, working with some of like the most difficult clients and converting them into like Amanda believers and filling really tough roles and just like stuff that was just, no one else had come in and like finessed and worked with this group. And I'm like, yeah, cause I'm, this is just you finally plugged me into the right place and like got me, you know, in a groove here. And so that then opened opportunity for me to navigate internally back into the function I wanted to be in, work I wanted to do. But it took a while. When you and I met, I was about a year in. I've been there 5.5, going on 6 now. And on my 4th team in theory. So had a few career transitions to promotion since then, like been able to put myself in a place and reflect on how I can add value and be distinct and like differentiate myself. Because I also thought a lot about, okay, if I want to get to the next level, like where is that a match? And then from there, okay, now to get to the next level, what team is that? What function is that? What part of the process is that? And was able to navigate with that lens in a way that made me relate to the work itself too, because there was an outcome and an ROI and kind of something that I was striving for.
Yeah. You could kind of see the end game.
Right.
Even if like, this wasn't exactly what you signed up for, you were able to like, so when you say, I'm just so curious, like, can you give a very concrete example of gamification?
Yes.
Like just one.
Okay. I don't want it to be too jargony for like what I do in my function though.
Okay.
It might be.
I'll ask you questions.
Yeah.
If so it is.
Gamification. So, I mean, I'm competitive by nature. I think that's probably.
Yeah, you are.
And I don't like to lose. And so if we're playing, you know, Monopoly and there's different things and there's ways to know to, you know, buy a property versus, you know, pay the rent on the, you know, as you're making your way around the squares and, you know, passing jail versus the impacts of not, you know, that's not always strategy, that sometimes, you know, just the luck of the dice, but figuring out what are the rules of the game in front of you that you're playing, your function, your role, you know, whatever that might be. If you're in sales, it's, you probably have a quota to hit. You probably have like numbers to make. And okay, how are you going to back into that? Not from a just like mechanical, if you need to get to 100, that means you need, you know, 2x, 3x, 4, whatever that is. But it's a real like, how can I navigate this in a way that like optimizes and hits a bunch of the main targets in a way that's almost like every day or every week or every month, kind of a, what am I checking off my scratch card or something? So for me, it was really like crushing the super near-term metrics that I had that were within my control. So regardless of what was going to happen, like my individual metrics were going to look a certain way. And I hacked the tooling a little bit to be as automatic and efficient as possible. And so that unlocked for me a shit ton of productivity so that I could actually get to the other side.
Yeah.
And I'm probably not answering your question at all.
I kind of know like, what you're saying.
Hopefully enlightening for some people, like where their opportunity is, if this is important to them. But you know, when I think about how I've helped others kind of see this, I've mentored quite a bit now and had a big responsibility for teammates and new hires. And, you know, it's definitely been a huge portion of also kind of how I'm viewed as like someone who can like help others come online to the work, you know, but it's really helping them understand like how this role is viewed. What's your part of the process? What tooling are you using to help you get there? And then, you know, really, again, optimizing and hacking a workflow that is automatic and is like intuitive, and you know, it might be calendar mapping in a certain way, or calendar blocking rather, so that you're, you know, working when you're most energetic on the work that you're most energized by, mm-hmm. and letting the other stuff kind of buffer your day. Or, you know, I was working predominantly on the East Coast with a West Coast team, so my mornings were mine before
everybody else came in. Yeah.
And then sometimes I would mentor someone who was also on the West Coast and be like, okay, so this really works well for me. And they'd be like, oh my God, well, I'm in meetings from as soon as my eyes open up. Yeah. And then by the time that, I'm like, oh, well, that sucks. Yeah. Like I actually think my structure is a little bit better. So maybe you want to go an hour early in, or mm-hmm. you want to block an hour in the middle. That's like a no meeting. You're going to get your shit done.
Yeah.
Those are, in my opinion, kind of like gamifying, kind of putting your boundaries and rules on your work in support of your outcome, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Yeah, I just like the way that you put that. And I think it's, especially because you're talking about things that are within your control, right? As opposed to like, I am going to have this many accepted offers instead of that, or like people accept my offers that I'm recruiting. It might be that you're like doing a certain number of outreaches on LinkedIn, or you're doing a certain, you know, like those are the kinds of things that you control and that don't involve other people. And so then you can set yourself up if you can back. So in other words, what you're doing is you're backing into your like concrete goals by just sort of setting up little metrics for yourself to hit that you know will result if it's worked the right way in that outcome.
Right. I mean, you definitely can have bad inputs into this work, but it's knowing also, and a lot of it was my own self-discovery of like, what made this all of a sudden a game that I was participating in? This wasn't a job I was like sledging through.
Right.
But how am I all of a sudden like, am I going to put an X or an O in this square? You know, if I know my entire day is going to, you know, be, and like, what's the path to, you know, a tic-tac-toe win? But another thing that I've also gamified of this is a much more concrete example. I, after a life event, a bad breakup, and just like trying to kind of familiarize myself with a new city that I'd moved to, you know, post-pandemic, all of that sort of stuff, I made a bingo square card for myself.
Okay.
Drew it up with my colorful markers. And it was, take a hike in the area, go to a coffee shop and only bring a book, like don't bring your phone.
Yeah.
Take a new yoga class or go to a brand new gym that you've never been to, you know, take a walk or talk to someone. I lived in an elevator building at the time, like talk to someone in your building today. Yeah. And so I had my bingo card in front of me for a month. And my challenge was to get a bingo or as many bingos as I could.
Wow.
I actually had two cards. One was a like Amanda self-care and one was like stretch opportunity. So, you know, putting ourselves out of our comfort zone. And that was a harder one to play, the self-care game. I was like, I can take a bubble bath every night for me. But that only got me one square.
Right.
So that's another like gamifying that way.
No, that's so fun. I love that.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about, so I work with mainly mid-career women who are either looking for a new job, or sometimes they're looking for a promotion or like a lateral move within their company. And a lot of like, a lot of what you deal with, right? Like where you're navigating through these big organizations, or there's like a big merger or whatever. And a lot of them ask me if they should be working with a recruiter. And I know there's different kinds of recruiters. So like, what is your advice to people about recruiters, when they're effective, what to look for, like what do you say about that?
Yeah. Well, my caveat here is, I say this all the time, especially as it relates to resume advice, is there's as many different ways to do a resume as there are coffee orders. So I'm a grande coconut milk latte from Starbucks, and I drink hot all year round, and that is a no-go for a lot of people. So, you know, my advice and my kind of view on this is very much like my preference. So working with recruiters can be really insightful just to know kind of also where you're at within the market. Like, it could give you perspective on like, oh, so I was looking for something new. I'm actually right now paid above market. Maybe there's a way for me to, you know, optimize where I'm at right now and maybe seek a promotion here or seek a bigger, you know, promotion or bonus structure or something of that nature. Yeah. So it can definitely give you perspective on your ability to make moves in either the direction you're currently on and understanding your market rate and that intelligence piece, or could really give you advice on the lifting and shifting and maybe career transition doing something else. So my style has always been super consultative. If I can't help someone, you know, I try to let them know as soon as possible just so that we know what our working relationship together is. Always trying to be, you know, a resource to them in any way. If they, you know, see someone on LinkedIn that I'm connected with at a company they're interested in, like, let me know and I'll put you in touch. But working with recruiters can sometimes be super transactional because recruiters can be rewarded monetarily based on placements, based on people in seats for the roles that they're filling. And so if they're not seeing dollar signs, and this is not all recruiters, but this is some recruiters, predominantly agency-based recruiters, you know, they're probably not going to build towards a relationship with you. But even when I sat in the seat of agency, I was probably a career counselor first.
Right.
But I mean, I had really strong referrals. I had really high retention rates. So the people I placed, especially on temporary assignments where, you know, they are working a job, you know, at an hourly rate, and then we're making a markup on their placement there. They stayed enrolled. They really understood kind of their relationship to the work as well. And I think that definitely translates into where I'm at now. And in-house recruiters, you know, I have worked predominantly on the business side in my time in recruiting, and then obviously within my current employer as well. And opportunities come back up, you know, roles come back online, or sometimes we're filling. I did internal audit recruiting, which is super niche.
Yeah.
And there's SOX audit, there's tech audit, there's, you know, corporate audit, there's all these different things. And so if I had a role that wasn't right then, you know, I was obviously networking with the candidate and then like, let's stay in touch. Let's keep working together because new roles will come online.
Right.
You know, that was true of my company at the size and scale that we're at. It might be less true at smaller organizations that, you know, fill a role once every few years. But, you know, understanding how to keep the relationship going, even from the, let's call it candidate, although, you know, that they might not truly be a candidate, but the relationship obviously goes both ways. Staying engaged on LinkedIn. I tell all candidates, like, find me on LinkedIn. Let's stay connected there. If you see something, shoot me an email. I say it's always the best place to find me because I'm on the phone with candidates or I'm in meetings with my hiring partners all day. So like email will be the way to find me. You know, and it really can be a referral-driven relationship where you're like, hey, I want to keep my name in your ecosystem because I have referrals that are interested, or I know people who are applying to your jobs and I want to like fast track them in the process so they don't just get like lost in the funnel of applicants. But it really depends on like what kind of organization it is, what nature of career pivot they might be making.
Yeah.
Sometimes folks leaving, say, academia, and I can't quite translate their skill set into the corporate environment, and it can be a tougher conversation.
Yeah.
I also think maybe first and foremost, I should have led with like, all feedback is meant with positive intent, hopefully,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. And
the help of what you're seeking. So even if it's a no, it's like, great, what can we take from this no, and how can we redirect that?
Mm-hmm.
So bringing that mindset and knowing that like, even those micro rejections along the way will infuse you with some sort of feedback and some sort of, you know, knowledge to take into your, you know, next iteration or your next attempt at something.
Yeah. 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 No, that's super helpful because I don't have specific recruiters that I personally have worked with or anything like that. And so it's one of those sort of mysterious boxes for me. And it's like good to understand a little bit about like the in-house recruiters versus agency recruiters and all of that. But I think people in those kinds of roles just have an enormous amount of information about whatever their specialty area is. So it seems like it's always a good idea to like at least connect with them so that you might be able to get some information, even if it's information you don't want, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And there's definitely, even within agency side, there's contingency and then there's a retainer.
Yeah.
So contingency is they get a commission if they fill the role.
Mm-hmm.
A retainer is usually at the, you know, executive kind of senior career, but, you know, folks might have never really worked with them. Some folks get placed always by a recruiter. It just depends on who their network is. But those retainers are, you know, we are filling this role. We have a fee up front. So mm-hmm. the quality of our placement is also going to be reflective of like how much we charged and, you know, how we about searching. And, but yeah, I mean, for a candidate point of view, understand what you're going towards, what you're trying to find, and then look for the recruiter that specializes in what you do. So like, I am not an engineer recruiter. I have not touched that other than one job, which it just was like, this is not my sweet spot. You know, anything on the business side, from legal to finance to sales to marketing to HR and, you know, all of that in between. I had a specialty for a while in finance and accounting in my earlier mm-hmm. years with Facebook Now. And now I'm kind of in this broader business group at the executive level that's a little bit less specialized and a bigger catch-all just based on some restructuring we've done. And if I'm not working on the search, I'll try to navigate that person to the right place.
Yeah.
But that comes with the like, we're building a relationship together. So I think having that understanding as well, not everyone's going to be proactive in putting you in the right spot. I know that it'll come around and, you know, there's conversion metrics that I would then benefit from and things that aren't necessarily like my goal and my performance, but they're part of my bigger story of like how I'm doing my job and doing it well. But yeah, LinkedIn is definitely a place that you should be on. You should be looking for, you know, recruiters in your specialty, companies that are your specialty, getting a connection somewhere, whoever can get you on the phone asking, you know, is this your main specialty? Do you have a division that does XYZ? Who's the main contact there? It's understanding how to navigate just the same way you, you know, if you wanted to get into an organization, you know, it's like, who's the head of that department? Who, if they have a job open, are they the hiring manager? Is it someone within their division? Let me find, sales has just been an easy example, but like, you know, I'm looking for a coordinator job within, you know, marketing. How can I find the marketing director and how can I work my way in there? So, you know, it does take some finessing and some navigating and just the confidence to like, I'm reaching out in search of this.
Yeah.
Can you support me in that?
Yeah. And so. It's like talking to people. I mean, it's really like being proactive and talking to, like putting yourself out there and say, I'm looking for this. And, you know, sometimes I would say a fair number of the people I work with feel very timid about that in many cases, but I think it's so critical and you just reinforce everything. So well done.
Well, a good recruiter will be personable and talkative and not, you know, hide behind a monitor only just because like that's the core function. I tell people I talk to strangers for a living.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
A lot of people I talk to daily aren't strangers and I talk to strangers for a living.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting. Yeah. Now I get that. I want to make sure that we have some time to talk a little bit about your side project. I know just from catching up with you recently that you are doing some coach training and are thinking about developing that as a, I don't know, as some sort of next evolution for Amanda's career. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I love too that you and I met primarily through a coaching program that we were enrolled in a group setting, which is an awesome and super accessible and affordable way for people to land kind of in a community of like-minded thinkers. But as I'm sure you've heard a little bit in my time today, like I'm super passionate about optimizing myself, optimizing you, mentoring, coaching, developing people. It's been a big part of my kind of renewal of the work that I do. So when I can bring someone kind of fully online into this job and help them succeed and sometimes, you know, crush my goals and ratings, you know, outperform me in a good way, you know, it's been really rewarding for me. So I've had a passion also of just personal development and kind of self-betterment for a long time. And so had the opportunity to enroll. I'm a little over halfway through an 8-month-long program right now that will, you know, give me deeper skills in this space. And, you know, it's not just like, let's career optimize, but let's also make sure that like our nervous system and our body and the language we're using is kind of in support of all of this. So super excited to figure out just by trial and error and seeing kind of who was also drawn to me and my, you know, background, you know, what this would be next and how to really leverage my executive background and working with executives, maybe executive coaching, maybe mid-career coaching. I'm super open to my clientele kind of coming to me and letting that be an organic, you know, matching. Mm-hmm. Really excited about that.
It's exciting. And it's like now we have even more to talk about.
We certainly do. So
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your career, your different choices, like speaking to my audience about being a recruiter and the different kinds of roles that they can play when people are thinking about making some sort of shift. I know people will find it invaluable. So appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Julie. Really excited to speak with you today and get to know your audience more.
Awesome. Thanks. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with my friend, Amanda Mayu. I got so much out of this interview and, you know, I feel like I know Amanda relatively well. And at the same time, doing these interviews just gives me so much perspective on how women navigate their careers. What I was really impressed by is at how so early in her career, Amanda was making decisions based on what her gut reaction was, what her experiences were. You heard her talk about working in New York City and running around for denim, and when she was doing an internship for Ralph Lauren, and how she realized as a result of that internship that this product development maybe wasn't the right thing for her, and that maybe working in a different role that was sort of textile or fashion apparel adjacent, right? Working in one of those companies in a different kind of role might be a better fit for her. So she loved New York. That was a clear yes. But when she returned to New York, she ended up taking not the job about denim that she was offered, but instead a job managing the floor at Bloomingdale's. And as you heard, this was a very powerful experience for her to have very early on in her career, where she was exposed to the CEO of Bloomingdale's, just because of the location of her office and the fact that she was at the flagship store. And she's a manager for the very first time of a unionized staff at age 22. So lots of steep learning curve, and clearly affected the path that she eventually took, which was to work more in a recruiting or HR capacity in different places and in different organizations. I also, just in terms of her more recent career, really appreciated Amanda's reflections on navigating large organizations and how, you know, there were moments in her career where she felt worried. I mean, she's at Meta. There were a bunch of layoffs and layoffs in general in the tech sector in early 2023. And one of the things that I think would be difficult about working at somewhere like that would be that worry that you're next, that you're next, that you're next, right? And I feel like Amanda was able to mitigate that fear because she was so exceptionally good at seeking out connections and mentors and developing a relationship with those mentors that really get to the point where they're more what I would call sponsors, right? Where they're really advocating for her behind closed doors, right? They're really going to bat for her. They're really giving her support and information and the different kinds of opportunities that she might need if her area changed in any way or she needed to make some sort of lateral move. And so I think that that's a very smart thing to think about and consider if you are in one of these large organizations. And then finally, and I had not talked to her about this, I was fascinated by her gamification of work and how that really led to her having a renewed passion for it. And you can hear me in the interview being like, well, so tell me an example of a game. Like, I don't understand. How are you gamifying your work? Now, this may not work for everyone, right? This idea of gamification. But Amanda's kind of competitive, and she's competitive with herself, and she's always pushing herself to do better. And I can see how if you gamify something and you set up little challenges for yourself that are both maybe both practical, but also like challenges to like take 10 minutes away from work and meditate or something like that. I mean, a reason that I think this works for Amanda is because she's competitive, but I think the reason it might work in general is because you're taking control over your day and the way you're working and the goals that you're going for. And that in and of itself can give you a sense of agency, a sense of confidence, a sense of accomplishment. And so I think it was really brilliant the way that she was able to gamify some of her work. And that then found that that was what really, really renewed her passion, her spark, her drive, her interest in the kind of recruiting work that she was doing. I hope you got a lot out of this episode. I'm so happy you're here. I will talk to you next time on Her Leading Story.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.
This has been an Awkward Sage production.